and related cases. And Mr. Shepler, we'll hear from you. Ms. Shepler.
May it please the court. If an attorney is going to accuse a party of being an illegal alien, he has to have evidence on his side. A trial court can't let a jury hear false accusations of illegal alien status. The risk of prejudice is just too high, and that's the whole point of Rule 403, to protect the party's substantial rights to an impartial jury. This case turns on the fact that Ramirez and Cifuentes had federal government-issued green cards. The government's purpose in issuing green cards is so that legal permanent residents can prove their legal status. Permanent residents rely on the green cards every day as proof of their legal status.
You would concede, I suppose, that it would be relevant in the case to the amount of damages that the jury might return for him as to whether he was illegal or legal?
It is a relevant question. And we conclusively proved that with the green cards, which we submitted.
Okay. So, and when was that submitted?
They were submitted on each party's direct examination. They were introduced for Mr. Ramirez's direct examination. It was cross. The cross-examination discussed the green card, and then it was eventually introduced into evidence on redirect.
All right. And you would concede that he was... that the defense attorney or the defense attorney could cross-examine him with respect to the green card?
Yes, Your Honor. But the defendants were not allowed to ask certain questions under Rule 403 if the probative value of those questions was outweighed by the unfair prejudice. To a certain extent...
What was unfair prejudice?
The unfair prejudice in this case is that they weren't illegal aliens. And
in other words, you're saying you had documentary proof that they weren't illegal aliens. And your argument is that there's constant reference in the record to their illegal alien status was basically to try to prejudice the jury. That's basically your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, Judge Jolly brings up an interesting point. To the extent that they were illegal or at times were illegal, why wouldn't that be relevant to their earning capacity?
Your Honor, they were legal permanent residents at all relevant times, from the time of the murder onwards.
Was there any dispute in the court below with reference to whether they were or not legal? In other words, was there a dispute before the district court? Did the district court know that they were in fact legal, that they had green cards and that they were legal?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court knew the party's positions. The district court acknowledged when they admitted the green cards over defendants' objections that the green cards were admitted into evidence, and if the defendants wanted to contest what the green cards meant, that they could call an immigration official to explain the dates on the cards if the defendants disagreed. But the defendants never called an immigration official, and the green cards were never rebutted with evidence. And in a courtroom, government documents are presumed to be legitimate. It was defendants' burden to rebut the green cards, but defendants didn't do that. And then after the direct and cross and redirect...
You're the one that introduced his illegality first, is it not?
No, Your Honor.
The plaintiffs, I mean, that's what I understood from the briefs, is that you introduced the status of the plaintiff's illegality. You said something to that effect.
With respect to one of the plaintiffs, didn't you all say that he illegally... elicited testimony that when he initially came over, he was illegal?
When he initially came over, yes, in the 1970s. And then the next question was, and you are a legal permanent resident, and here's your green card, which said for Mr. Ramirez that he had been a legal permanent resident since December 1st, 1990, which is years before the relevant time period in this case. The murder took place in 1996. So for all relevant points for damages or otherwise, going to whether or not they deserved relief for being sent to jail and being arrested in the first place, they were legal permanent residents at that time.
And that's undisputed and unquestionable.
It is undisputed and is unquestionable because if the defendants had called an immigration official, they would have seen that on the face of Mr. Ramirez's green card, it said he was an S-26 category legal permanent resident, which meant by statute that he applied in 1988 as an agricultural worker, and he did receive legal permanent resident status in 1990.
I mean, that would have been available to the defendant only if he had called an immigration official?
Well, Your Honor, by statute, it says that the code refers to a statute, and you can look that up, or you can call an immigration official.
Well, did the defendant's attorney know all of this at the time that he was injecting the illegality of the plaintiff's status?
We don't know, Your Honor. All we know is the defendant's burden to rebut the green cards. The defendant's never called an immigration witness, even though he was invited twice by the district court to do so. And at the end of the day,
well,
the green cards...
That doesn't mean that he can't cross-examine.
No, Your Honor. He can ask questions, but again, there is Rule 403 balancing. And if we get past the green cards, the defendants continue to ask prejudicial testimony of the damages expert. He not only referred to Ramirez and Cifuentes as illegal aliens, but as illegal persons, as illegal workers, as people who are here illegally, as people who work illegally, as they are simply illegal. He asked the damages expert whether he could be deported back.
Would you think in a 27-day trial that might be said more than once or twice?
Yes, Your Honor, but...
Are there questions about, with respect to the damages expert, was he cross-examined on the basis that it would, or was an argument made to the jury that they would not have damages because they couldn't legally work, when in fact they could legally work?
Exactly.
Okay. Now, would you explain to me a little bit about what the jury, or how the verdict came down? Was it based on no damages? Did they find no constitutional violation? What happened here? What are we talking about?
Okay, so the harm here goes to whether or not the jury could have thought that they were illegal aliens. And had the jury thought that Ramirez and Cifuentes were illegal aliens, they could have thought that they didn't deserve justice for getting arrested and being sent to jail. Illegal aliens, by definition, are breaking the law.
Tell me what they could have thought. What did the jury do? Did they find a constitutional violation, or did they find no constitutional violation, or did they find a constitutional violation but no damages? Tell me what they did.
They found no constitutional violation, Your Honor. But if the jury was prejudiced against illegal aliens for whatever reason, if it came out in the course of the damages testimony.
So what the jury did is they rejected the argument of the plaintiffs that they were arrested and prosecuted on the basis of the Fourth, in violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Yes, Your Honor. But the prejudice that the jury could have felt towards illegal aliens in this case goes to whether they deserve justice at all. If they were breaking the law by being in this country in the first place, a jury could conclude that either they were not entitled to the same protections of the law, or that they didn't deserve justice for being sent to jail when they weren't supposed to be here in the first place.
You filed a motion in limine to
yes,
keep
Your Honor.
Statements out, and the district court ruled against that.
We filed the motion in limine to exclude the prior arrests and prior deportation history before the relevant events in this case, and that was denied by the district court.
At that point, you had to take the sting out of the evidence, and you raised it initially yourself, both the original illegal alien status that led to deportation, and then you affirmatively offered the green card.
Right.
Why, just threshold question, why doesn't Oler prevent you from alleging error? Having made the decision after losing the pretrial motion to go ahead and introduce the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, apart from the pretrial motion, we presented affirmative evidence of legal permanent residence. The reversible error in this case goes to the false accusations of illegal alien status at the time of arrest and imprisonment.
And that wasn't encompassed in your pretrial motion?
Correct. Okay. And we objected at trial.
But then I guess just because a 403 objection is a very specific one. Mm-hmm. Could you point me to the place in the record where the district court abused its discretion under 403 and allowed in evidence, false evidence, as opposed to attorney questions about it that gave implications? Where specifically was there evidence that came in, admitted, and you objected saying, no, Your Honor, this isn't covered by our pretrial motion and it is impermissible. It's relevant under 401, but it's impermissible because it's unfairly prejudicial.
Well, Your Honor, in the damages section, when they were cross-examining the damages expert, even though they were asking questions, they elicited testimony in response to those questions.
Okay, and what is an example? Give me your best example of some inflammatory, unfairly prejudicial answer, that is, evidence that would be governed by 403.
Okay, well, there were a series of questions.
I know, I'm not looking for the questions, because okay. I assume a pattern instruction was given to this jury, disregard attorney questions. The only thing Rule 403 would apply to would be evidence that actually was admitted improperly. So I'm just looking for an answer specifically, because that would focus it to the issue you presented on appeal.
Okay, so the damages expert got in a fight with the defendants about whether or not he could be deported. That was,
if you can, just recite to me an answer that was given that you think was unfairly prejudicial. It outweighed the relevance you admit exists as to damages. Because I couldn't find it, and we have to navigate around Oler, even if Oler's a harsh rule.
Okay. Okay, well,
you can come, you're going to get back up, so you can look at it then. Continue
okay,
with your
great,
argument.
Great, okay. So going back to the question about whether this only goes to damages, the harm in falsely accusing of Ramirez and Cifuentes of being illegal aliens, and with the questions, there was created a confusion, an unfair impression before the jury, that the jury could have been confused. And in fact, it wasn't just the questions, but it was the district court overruling the 403 objections and allowing the district court to continue to ask questions.
The spillover from these questions, you're presuming that there was some, or thinking that it was confused, there was some spillover from these questions having to do with an improper use of their status for damages into the liability question of constitutional violation.
Yes, Your Honor.
What, other than you're saying there could have been confusion, did they argue to the jury anything along the lines of what you're talking about, that illegals don't have a right to be free from, that somehow or other there's no constitutional violation because they're illegal, or that they're not entitled to the same protections as other people? What do you have other than this argument about this could have happened?
Well, Your Honor,
the defendant actually doing something to promote that happen?
Well, Your Honor, this court said in Rojas that a court could readily conclude that illegal aliens are not equal before the law to law-abiding citizens and jurors.
But your answer to Judge Benavides is nothing.
Is they did not argue that directly. They did not argue that they didn't have rights, but they argued continually that they were illegal aliens, illegal persons.
As I understand it, too, the summation, the defendants did not mention illegality. But the plaintiffs did mention illegality.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. But the damage had already been done through the questions, with all of their questions. They created confusion that maybe Ramirez and Cifuentes were illegal aliens. And that is rebutted by the evidence of the green cards. And it was defendants' burden, if they disagreed with what the green card said, it was defendants' burden to present an affirmative case as to why the green cards didn't mean what they say.
Wait a minute, where do you get that?
Because government documents are presumed
that they had a burden. They could not cross-examine. They could not mention the terms illegality until they called a witness from the Immigration Service.
No, Your Honor, it's not the cross-examination about the cards. It's the other testimony that insinuates that Ramirez and Cifuentes.
Like what?
Like, for example, going back to the damages expert, they repeatedly asked whether or not about the possibility that Ramirez and Cifuentes could be deported, could get deported, could be deported back to Mexico,
well,
and then
is that relevant to income?
Whether or not they were illegal aliens or legal permanent residents is the question relevant to damages. But they were legal permanent residents,
but
therefore,
if legal permanent residents, they still can be deported.
Correct, but under the damages.
I mean, in fact, I guess they were probably deported, or would have been deported if they'd gotten out of jail with a conviction.
Correct, but the damages probability of an illegal alien being deported is higher than a legal permanent resident being deported, which is where that question comes into account. But the defendants went on to ask the damages expert to go into Southwest Lubbock and talk to roofing crews of illegal aliens to see how much they made versus how much legal workers made. That question was not relevant to this case because defendants were legal permanent residents at all relevant times.
In other words, you're saying it just wasn't relevant. Their illegality, as used by the defense, wasn't relative to the damages question because they were legally allowed to work because they were legally here, according to the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you ever make the objection on that basis?
That they were legally here? Yes, Your Honor. We objected repeatedly.
Your Honor, this is not legally relevant to their wages because they have all testified that they were legal and we've introduced the green card?
Yes, there was references, there was sidebars and direct testimony with Ramirez, and there was references in the damages. This goes to the legal versus legal question that we've already discussed, objection preserved. And in closing, if I can just briefly say, the legitimacy of the green cards was never rebutted. The defendants' questions had no probative value, therefore, and at the end of the day, the defendants can't give you any justification for asking the damages expert about roofing crews of illegal aliens in Southwest Lubbock.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chaplow. Mr. Sullivan, we'll hear from you.
May it please the Court, James P. Sullivan for Salvador Abreu. I'll be joined at the podium today by William Helfand, who served as trial counsel for co-defendants. Plaintiffs ask this court to discard a 27-day trial, ignore a jury verdict, and reverse the district court's judgment, and they ask for all of this on the basis of Rule 403. This court should reject that invitation for two reasons. First, the district court did not commit a clear abuse of discretion where it declined to exclude evidence of plaintiff's immigration status. Second, plaintiffs have not carried their burden of showing how any such evidentiary error affected their substantial rights.
There's a question there on the first. Questions regarding immigration status is one thing. Okay, let's forget about that. Let's say you can raise questions and ask questions about immigration status, and that would be relevant. Okay, this is beyond the status now. Now we're talking about if the record establishes that they are in fact legal, and you continue to call them illegal and continue to ask questions on the basis that they're illegal and ask questions about damages on the basis that they're illegal when the record shows that they're legal, why isn't that wrong?
I'm not sure whether that's right or wrong. I'm not sure doctrinally how the truth of the propositions, that is, as kind of a view from Olympus truth, would affect the Rule 403 weighing. But it also—
Is there any dispute that they had a green card?
Well, there's not a dispute—
If they have a green card, they can work here, can't they?
Well, Your Honor, they can work here now with the green card that they have, but it is incorrect to say that on this record that it was conclusively established that the plaintiffs were lawful permanent residents circa 1996 when they were arrested and imprisoned. Now, my friend in opposition has said that the green card is a government document that is proof of the proposition for which it stands, but of course that begs the question, what proposition does it stand for? And in this case, the testimony that was elicited on cross-examination of Ramirez went to precisely that point. So on cross-examination, Ramirez was asked, isn't it true that the 1990 date on your green card reflects the fact that you got it from an amnesty program for people who were in the country unlawfully?
Okay, well, let's say that that's okay.
Okay, and
let's say that question's
right.
Okay.
So we know that has to do with his status. Okay, so we know that
What do you do with the questions now? You've determined his status. He's got green cards, and you continue to call him illegal.
Well, but I think that the point here is that the evidence, and Judge Higginson's point about Rule 403, I think, is well taken. It's only about the evidence. And the defendants in this case, after the plaintiffs opened the door to this sort of evidence, was stacked against their assertion.
Wait a minute. Let's talk about this open the door.
Yes.
When he originally came over here, he came over illegally.
Yes.
Right?
And then he's got
a green card. Why does that opening the door mean that he's always illegal?
I don't think that it opens the door to false assertions that he is always illegal, and I don't think that it would establish that fact. But the testimony elicited from Ramirez suggested, we asked him, do you have the card that you say that you had when you went into prison? And he said, no, I don't have that. And we said, okay, when you got to TDCJ custody, were you allowed to take educational classes that were not open to people who were not lawfully in the country? And he said, no, I wasn't allowed to do that either. And then we said, isn't it true that you've lied under oath in the past to federal officials about your lawful permanent resident status in this country? And he said, yes, that's true too. So what we have here is we have evidence from the plaintiffs of their lawful permanent resident status, and then we have evidence from the defendants tending to rebut that. That's exactly how a trial should work when a party opens the door and opens up the relevance of a particular subject here.
You know, the way I read their briefs is that it's like the entire trial was infected as a matter of due process, not by any one incident, but by accumulation of constantly referring to them as illegals in a disparaging way.
Right, and 2 points on that. First, that isn't the point that they've raised on appeal. They've raised a Rule 403 point. But second, Judge Jolly, as your question when my friend in opposition was at the podium made quite clear, it is incorrect for them to characterize defendant's strategy in this case as a, quote, illegal alien strategy. That suggests that this was something that was coming up constantly and that we were always trying to get into the record. But as has been correctly pointed out from the bench, this was not mentioned by defendants in their opening. It was not mentioned by defendants in their closing arguments. It didn't come up until the 16th day of trial after plaintiffs had opened the door to this kind of a discussion. So we basically have two periods where this phrase, which I would
consider. I'm assuming you aggressively and successfully opposed the motion in limine.
We did oppose the motion.
So it came as no surprise that then they had to address the issue because you'd already prevailed in.
I think that that's incorrect, Judge Higginson, and it's a good question that I think raises an important point about this record. Your Honor has asked about the kind of removing the sting point, and you've already gotten my first response to that, which is that you go look at Oler, and you've obviously already done that.
Well, but you didn't urge Oler, so you've waived Oler, which is a waiver case. You didn't urge to us.
Oh,
you're saying open the door, but you aren't saying that they've foreclosed.
No, that's right.
You're not urging that we decide this based on Oler.
No, you should not decide it based on
Why
waiver.
Why not?
First of all, the preemptive self-defense point that my friends in opposition have raised was not raised until the reply brief, if I'm remembering the briefing correctly. But our understanding of the opening the door doesn't have to do with waiver. It has to do with the effect that it has on the relevance of this piece of evidence.
But that's conceding that open door concept concedes there's error. It may be your alternative argument. Your first argument is this is relevant under 401 and no abuse of discretion on 403. If I lose under that, you're saying it's not a miscarriage of justice, it's harmless because we were responding to them.
No, not quite. What I'm saying is that this evidence was relevant and that probative value was not substantially outweighed by any
that's
unfair prejudice. But that's true. That relevance appears precisely because they've opened the door. The Wright and Miller treatise has an excellent discussion of this point about how open the door is a phrase that kind of draws in a lot of different concepts. But one of them, and an important one in the Rule 403 context, is when one side starts talking about it, even if it wasn't relevant before, it becomes more relevant.
Yeah, but it's trickier. I mean, obviously, I'm assuming you proceeded or you would have proceeded very carefully in light of the Royes decision, where we said this is an area where prejudices do abound, and you've really got to avoid mentioning illegal alienage unless there's a high probative value to it. And there, the only reason the case was saved was because the entire jury had been asked about it in voir dire.
Right.
So I'm assuming you know that it really shouldn't be much part of this case.
And it really wasn't, and it didn't become one. As counsel for the Attorney General of Texas, we recognize that the phrase illegal alien is not the preferred nomenclature. At the same time, by my recent count last week, in 8 published opinions from this court in 2012 alone, that precise term has been used. So we think that reasonable minds could differ about the use of potentially inflammatory language. I would add that Rojas.
Let me get to you. I know the Attorney General is trying to do good things.
thank you, Your Honor. Tell my boss.
No, I didn't mean that facetiously. When you ask the expert on damages about damages being less if they were illegal, that they shouldn't be hired, did that occur after it had been developed that these people had green cards? Or before?
It occurred after, but it also occurred
at that time, there was nothing to rebut the idea that they had green cards.
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor. The testimony that I previously referred to, that is the testimony about doesn't that date reflect the program under which you got the card? Didn't the TVCJ classify you as unlawful? Why don't you have your old card and why don't you show it to us? And if we're supposed to take your word as to your status circa 1996, haven't you lied about that before? All of that came on cross-examination of Ramirez, And then and that was on the 16th and 17th days of the trial. And then on the 18th day, when Ewing, the plaintiff's damages expert, came to the stand, there was a record to suggest that you do need to account in your calculations for the possibility that the wage rate might have been different. If I could just return, I'm sorry, to Judge Higginson's question, though, about this taking out the sting, there's a second point apart from Oler that does a lot of work here, and that is that it is incorrect to say, as plaintiffs do in their brief, that the district court wouldn't lift a finger to help them keep out this evidence. If you look to page 11,454 of the record on appeal, and for those in the audience, this is why it's sometimes an odd choice of our living to be appellate lawyers, 11,454, the district court said that the motion to exclude this evidence was, quote, denied at this time. Plaintiffs may make objections pertaining to the admissibility of any testimony or other evidence at the time of trial. So it was a conditional denial of the plaintiff's efforts to keep this testimony out. So for them to now say that they both knew the mind of the defendant's counsel and knew the mind of the district court as to whether that evidence would be admitted does not withstand scrutiny under the record.
You were going to say something about Royas. Do you want?
Yes, I'm sorry. I was going to say that in this court's opinion in Royas, after they had vacated and granted rehearing, the Royas court itself used the phrase illegal alien, which again may not be the preferred nomenclature, in referring to the plaintiff in that case. And I think that context matters in the Royas case, and I commend the opinion to your attention because the use of illegal alien did not stand on its own to give that kind of incendiary impression.
What is the politically correct term to use?
Well, we've tried to refer to the evidence of immigration status, and that's not an effort to conflate any of the different types of evidence. I think that what has been found offensive based on what I've read in the New York Times and things of that nature is it's the notion of defining a person as illegal. That is, that their very personhood breaks the law and is somehow an affront to the state.
Hey, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Helfen, we'll hear
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm going to set aside my prepared notes. I'd like to address some of the questions that the Court has asked, since I seem to be the only person before the bar today who actually was involved in the trial of this case. And I want to pick up first with Judge Higginson's question. To be honest with Your Honor, all of the defense counsel were frankly shocked by the fact that plaintiffs chose to address the issue of their status in the voir dire and to raise it in their own direct examinations. The opposition to the motion in limine was based upon the expectation that the expert would be questioned about the differential value of lost work related to authorization to work within the United States and the lack of authorization to work within the United States. And in fact, the record demonstrates that shock, Your Honor, in that in a bench conference in which we were opposing the admissibility of the green cards, again, some 16 days into the trial of the case, we pointed out that the green cards had not been disclosed by the plaintiffs and that we had not done any discovery on the existence of any green cards. So not only were we shocked that the plaintiffs chose to inject this into the case in such a robust way, we were shocked that they had green cards and that they wanted to put them into evidence because they had never offered them at any time. In fact, what we had in contrast, and this goes to Judge Benavides' question, was a significant amount of information which suggested that at relevant times related to this case, at the time of their arrest and subsequent thereto, they were not authorized to work in the United States. And by the way, I know there's been some discussion about the use of the term illegal alien. I think if you look in the record, you'll find that the plaintiffs actually chose to use the term illegal alien significantly more than any defense counsel. Although my co-counsel used it from time to time, and I may have at bench conferences, for the most part, what we were talking about was legally authorized to work in the United States. Now, what we had was no green cards from the plaintiffs. They were not in disclosures nor otherwise referenced in discovery. But we did have documents, again, official documents, which apparently opposing counsel would say are conclusive, that at the time of the arrest, both were considered to be unauthorized to
be in
the United
States. You didn't know they had green cards. You thought they were illegal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When you went into trial, you did not know about the green cards. You had evidence to show that they had been deported because they didn't have documentation, and so you had a belief that they were illegal.
That and more, Your Honor. At the time of their arrest, again, to use my opposing counsel's comment, an official government document found that they were both unauthorized to be in the United States.
Okay. Well, let's say you then you find out that they have green cards. Now, is there a dispute as to whether those green cards are valid or not?
There most certainly is, Your Honor. There most certainly is.
And did you all bring that up to the attention of the judge? Or how did,
Well, here's how that happened.
I mean, because you can't say, well, since I thought they were illegal, I have a right to treat them as illegal, even though I've now found out that they're legal. You're not telling me that.
No, I wholeheartedly agree with Your Honor. But in the face of conflicting evidence, an advocate has the right to point out those conflicts in the evidence. Mm-hmm. So we have the documents related to their arrest which find that they're unauthorized to be in the United States, which, as Your Honor knows, is a consideration under the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure as to bond. So we have an official government document showing at the time of arrest in 1996 they are unauthorized to be in the United States. Both Mr. Ramirez and Mr. Cifuentes claim to have had authorization, which they say somehow expired, and they have no evidence of that prior authorization or expiration. But what they do claim is that Haynes and
Boone. Well, don't green cards expire?
I don't know, Judge, but here's, I think that they do, but here's the point. They didn't have any evidence that they had a green card prior to meeting the lawyers from Haynes and Boone. The record shows that both lawyers said Haynes and Boone, which was their lawyers in this case, helped them get their green cards. Now, the evidence established that these men didn't meet the lawyers from Haynes and Boone until sometime while they were incarcerated.
Okay.
So if Haynes and Boone helped them, then ipso facto, there's a serious question as to whether they actually got those green cards while in prison. Now, the record will show that I asked Judge Cummings if he was going to admit the green cards, to require Haynes and Boone to turn over their file for each of these men on obtaining the green cards, and Judge Cummings said he would not. Now, there was a suggestion made by Judge Cummings, which was echoed by opposing counsel, that we call somebody from Immigration and Naturalization. I will tell you that I tried during the trial to get somebody from INS to come and testify at the trial. What they told us was, you send us a subpoena in Lubbock, we send that to Dallas, you wait to hear back, we challenge that subpoena, because we always do, and we had an INS agent who said he would love to testify.
Was the green card ever produced?
The green cards were never produced until trial.
Okay. And did they show when they were authorized or when the issue date was?
They don't show an issue date. They show an effective date, to my recollection.
Okay, and so we have the green cards, we have an effective date. What was the effective date?
Well, the effective date for Mr. Ramirez is 1990, and that's very interesting because it was the INS officer.
Okay, is that prior to the incarceration?
It is prior to the arrest and the incarceration.
All right, so you got a green card prior to the incarceration. That's it. You see, he's not illegal then, right, for the relevant – I mean, he's legal for the relevant time period. How about the other fellow? Did you have a green card?
He had a green card.
Did it have an issue date or an effective date?
It has an effective date, I believe, of 1993, Your Honor.
And that's prior to the incarceration?
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay. Is there so from that documentary evidence, during their time, at least the beginning of their incarceration, they were legal. We just don't know when they expired.
I'm afraid that that's not correct, Your Honor. And that's, again, when Judge Cummings referred me to immigration, The cross-examination of Mr. Ramirez that you see of my questions of Mr. Ramirez as to the 1990 date were because the immigration officer told me the 1990 date is not the effective date that he was granted status. It is a catch-all date we use for everyone under that amnesty program. In other words, he could have been granted
could have
that
later statement. And it would have used the same date.
Yes, sir. And that's exactly why I asked that question at trial. And don't forget, Mr. Ramirez agreed. He agreed that that 1990 date was because of an amnesty program, not because he was necessarily legally authorized to be in the United States.
Do we have anything in the record that conclusively establishes any of this stuff?
No. What we had was differential evidence. And so that brings me to Judge Higson's question. I respectfully disagree with my opposing counsel that a lawyer may not ask a question under Rule 403 where there is differential evidence. There is evidence on both sides of this question. And so I don't think it's appropriate to say that at the time, just imagine the rule that you would be enunciating if you followed what opposing counsel is asking you here. I present evidence of a fact. A lawyer cannot ask questions about the validity of that alleged fact. That's essentially what's being proposed here. Obviously, that's why this court has always demonstrated the greatest deference to trial court's evidentiary rulings. And in this case, it's quite appropriate. Judge Cummings heard this case over the course of 6 weeks, and the argument that somehow it turned upon illegal alien status is simply absurd. We talked about the status of these individuals in the record with three people, and in each case,
I want to not to get you off
yes, sir.
Train of thought, but I understood that they did not have, that one of them did not have and did not produce their green card and was asked about it, and he says, I have lied about it before as well.
Well, that's Mr. Ramirez. That's right. Mr. Ramirez
that's
claimed to...
Not your client.
One of the plaintiffs, Mr. Ramirez, had claimed to be a U.S. citizen at one time. He had been incarcerated for lying to immigration officials under oath, for attempting to bring people in and himself across the border illegally, but he had been incarcerated, which was an additional reason that Judge Cummings found this evidence to be admissible, not only his illegal status, but his efforts at illegal border crossing and ferrying other illegal individuals across the border. And that was because he was claiming mental anguish from being incarcerated, and Judge Cummings agreed that prior incarcerations would go to the jury's consideration of how much mental anguish he actually had. But all of that brings me, in the short time that I've left, to this conclusion. The suggestion that somehow this case turned on the status or discussions of the status of these individuals is simply folly. You have a 6-week trial that was attended to fastidiously by Judge Cummings, carefully watching everything that was going on. What you have is lawyers who were not at the trial who have read the record and assigned some great significance to something that I don't think the jury paid much attention to at all. As Judge Jolly pointed out, they didn't even reach the question of damages, which is the only place that the defendants ever raised this question with any witness.
There was talk in the briefs about photographic evidence and the Mexican consulate affiliation. Was that being offered by the plaintiffs and you were responding to it, or was that affirmatively offered by you?
The plaintiffs offered against Mr. Ponce the argument that he had inappropriately given a photo array to a lady named Brenda Ayala. The role of the Mexican consulate, again, was raised by the plaintiffs. Actually, the defendants didn't respond to that at all. They took the position that under Supreme Court and Fifth Circuit precedent, there was a fact question for the jury as to the propriety of the photo array, and that the jury found the photo array not to have violated the Constitution. So
I'm going to take you outside of your time. I think it expired, but would you briefly tell me what was the focus of the defense on the constitutional violation? I'm not talking about damages. What was your basic defense with the idea with reference to no violation?
I appreciate that, Your Honor. At the very outset of the case, Judge Cummings required us to do opening and voir dire as one matter. I had a chart. It was a pinwheel with Mr. Ramirez and Mr. Cifuentes at the center, and I apologize I didn't bring it. And it demonstrated 5 different points, independent points of probable cause leading to a determination, leading to a determination of probable cause that these gentlemen had committed the crime for which they were accused. And those points were statements by the individual who was murdered before she passed away.
So your defense, short answer is you had various issues with respect to probable cause for the detention.
5 different evidentiary bases, all independent of each other. Yes, Your Honor. And ultimately, I think that's why the lawyers who tried this case, including the lawyers for Mr. Ramirez and Mr. Cifuentes, reported immediately after the trial that they felt that they got a fair trial, that they appreciated the jury's consideration, and that they were not going to appeal. Moreover,
I think you've answered my question.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Okay, Ms. Shapleau. No, I'm sorry. Mr. Shaw.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few brief matters addressed by opposing counsel. First of all, I believe Mr. Helfand, Counselor Defendant Ponce, said that they were shocked that the issue of that this was the first that they'd heard that these were legal permanent residents. That's not true for several reasons. First of all the motions said Mr. Ramirez, Mrs. Fuentes were our legal permanent residents. Second of all, they said this was the first time they had seen the green card. I'm not entirely sure about Mr. Ramirez, but for Mr. Cifuentes, his green card was an exhibit at his deposition. And bear in mind also that Mr. Fuentes received his legal permanent resident status as a matter of marrying a U.S. citizen. This whole amnesty answer doesn't even touch him. Also, I believe Mr. Helfand said that he spoke to an immigration official who said that perhaps amnesty is the reason for this sort of backdating. That's not on the record. I'd be surprised to see where it was because, as our brief points out, if you go back to the actual statutes at issue, they do set specific deadlines for when you need to apply for this program and when you are granted legal permanent residence. The law is fairly clear, Your Honor, that Mr. Ramirez had to apply by, I believe, a certain date in 1988. And because he applied by that date, he got his legal permanent residence status, along with everyone else who applied by that date, on December 1st, 1990.
Did the district judge believe that there was an issue with respect to whether or not these people were illegal or not illegal, or was he going on the basis that somehow or other this had something to do with damages?
Your Honor, it's unclear, because when during Mr. Ramirez's direct testimony, we elicited the fact that he was a legal permanent resident at the time in question and offered his green card as a demonstrative. There was some dispute over it, and the judge said, why do we have to talk about this? He has testified that he was a legal permanent resident. Based on that, it sounds like the district court judge at that time saw the green card and said he was a legal permanent resident. The problem is that he didn't continue to enforce that ruling. When they pulled in evidence that had little to no probative value in light of the green card, the judge allowed that questioning to continue, and it's not clear why he did so. I believe also Judge Higginson was asking about the state prison classification. Why was that not probative versus prejudicial? For one simple reason. Testimony about what Mr. Ramirez thought that the state prison's guess was about his federal immigration status does not actually go to the green card itself. It in no way rebuts the green card, which says in plain language, resident since December 1, 1990. There is no evidence in this record that rebuts that evidence. Additionally, Your Honor, I believe you were asking that he might have been illegal when he went into jail, but then the green cards expired. To be clear, green cards may expire, but legal permanent resident status never does. The immigration office, basically you need to renew the green card just to show in case there were changes with the green card or not, but you are still a legal permanent resident even if you have an expired green card. Also, there was a lot of focus on whether the term illegal alien is particularly egregious. And as Mr. Sullivan said, that's a term that the state prefers not to use. But this case isn't about just the term. It's not. It's about the status. It's about accusing Mr. Ramirez and Mr. Fuentes about being illegal aliens between 1996 and 2008, during the relevant time period, because that affects the jury's consideration of their case in two ways. One, as a matter of damages, what they said. Second, because as this court's decision Rojas said, someone who is illegal, the jury might think that they are not equal before the law. They are not entitled to the same constitutional protections. Many courts, including this court, have said that sometimes illegal aliens don't
have.
That's
the most inflammatory evidence. Did you have an opportunity?
Yes, Your Honor.
So specifically what I'm wondering is the evidence that was admitted as to illegal alien between 96 and 2008. Where was evidence admitted and objected to, as distinct from questions asked about it?
Yes, Your Honor. It does flow from the question, so if I could tell the question and then the answer. The question was he legally here in the United States? Did he have any? Was he legally here in the United States during the time period that you estimated his earnings capacity? And the answer was, from an earnings capacity standpoint, it doesn't matter if a person, from an economic standpoint, that's what I'm supposed to give my opinion about. It doesn't matter whether they're a permanent resident, illegal alien, or whatever. I'm here to estimate and provide my opinion. The problem with these questions, Ron, the evidence that the answer that was, sorry, I mean.
Don't, yeah, there's no evidence admitted there standing for the proposition you said is so inflammatory. That's, is that the evidence that was admitted that you say is the most unfairly prejudicial?
Well, no, also the answer that I was given is that, however, if he's deported or whatever, I'm not an attorney to say whether or not he can work here legally. The reason that is prejudicial, Your Honor, is that it opens the door to the jury to decide that maybe they're illegal. Maybe they are illegal aliens. Even though we've heard all this evidence, even though we have a green card that the judge allowed in, you know what? Now the judge is allowing questions saying that, hey, maybe they were illegal. This is now an open issue, and as a jury member, I can think that they might have been illegal. That's why the answers that were given are important. And it does depend on the question, because the questions asked the expert witness assume that he wasn't illegal. And the expert witness says, well, my calculations may or may not take into that account over objection.
Okay, Mr. Shaw, thank you very much. We'll call the next case of the day.